The Summer Olympic Games will open in 3 weeks with great fanfare in Rio de Janeiro. Brazil's leaders initially hoped that hosting the Games would allow the country to show off the enormous economic progress it's made in recent years. But now there's concern that the Games may only serve to further expose a corrupt political system that fails the general public while rewarding a select group of wealthy businessmen. Alex Quadros knows a great deal about wealthy Brazilians. He worked for 5 years as a billionaire reporter for Bloomberg News in São Paulo, and he recently completed his first book, Brazilianaires, about the lives of Brazil's top 0.001% and how they got where they are. It's published by Spiegel & Grau, and I'm very pleased it has brought Alex Quadros to our show. Hello.
Hello.
It's a little hard to believe a billionaire reporter is a real job. Was that the title listed on your business card?
It wasn't actually on my business card, but it was my official internal title. And it is a strange thing, and it's something that didn't exist until recently. But basically, in 2011, Bloomberg News decided to create a team of journalists that would only cover the world's billionaires. It was in the wake of the financial crash and, the rise of billionaires was kind of the zeitgeist, and they decided to go after that. And they asked me to be the guy to cover the billionaires of Latin America.
You were already in Colombia at the time.
I spent 2 years in Colombia.
Where most of the billionaires were involved in the drug trade, or is that just an American fantasy?
Well, there are definitely some very rich people involved in the drug trade, but there are a lot of legitimate businesses there as well. And it's a country where it has an economy of a certain size. It has very rich people in retail and oil and so on, but very concentrated in a few hands.
Is it easy to make the transition from speaking Spanish to Portuguese?
It was, actually. I spoke Spanish fluently by the time I got to Brazil, and it made it a lot easier to pick up Portuguese because on the page, at least, they're very similar. The sounds are really different. And it was a struggle at first because I got there thinking, oh, I'll just wing it. And the very first time I went, I arrived at the airport in Rio and got a taxi. And when the guy started speaking, it sounded like it was all just one long vowel with bits of falsetto here and there.
It's a very pretty sounding language.
It's beautiful. I love the language.
When we are talking about billionaires, are we talking about $1 billion or 1 billion Brazilian reals?
We're talking about $1 billion, which is, I guess, equally arbitrary as 1 billion reals, but yes, $1 billion.
Brazil was experiencing an economic boom when you arrived in 2010.
Yeah, I arrived at a moment when there was an almost euphoric feeling in the country and outside of the country about the way that the country was changing. Tens of millions of people had been lifted from extreme poverty. Commodity prices were booming, and Brazil is a huge exporter of iron ore and oil and so on. And it was something that was evident everywhere, almost palpable, this incredible optimism.
Although you write that you wondered whether the ultra-rich take a society forward or hold it back, and if billionaires create progress or if progress creates billionaires. Were you able to figure that out?
Yeah, well, I went into this topic not really having any preconceived ideas about these people. It's not like I ever pursued billionaires on purpose. This job kind of fell in my lap, and I went in with an open mind trying to figure out what is the balance of these two kind of cliches of what billionaires are. You know, are they the harbingers of progress, or are they a, you know, cabal of monopolists? And in the end, I think the reality is somewhere between those extremes. But I do think that whenever you have extremely concentrated wealth, it becomes a danger for the functioning of free markets and for the functioning of governments.
How many billion? I'm sorry, I interrupted you. How many billionaires are there in Brazil?
Well, there are ever fewer these days because the local currency, the real, has lost a lot of value against the dollar. But there are still something like 50. At the peak of the economic boom there were close to 100.
You said that it has an impact on the government when I interrupted you. You want to get back to that?
Yeah. Well, what you see in Brazil is a very raw relationship between billionaires and the government. They often try to influence public policy through outright corruption. And there are many fortunes that are, you know, could be said to be dirty money. But I think this is actually a natural relationship between wealth and political power. Whenever a billionaire gets to a certain level, you know, I think that he or she tries to defend and maintain that wealth by putting their money to work in the political system.
For many years, Brazil was an impoverished dictatorship, and then when democracy was reinstated, everything looked great. But now it's a country in turmoil. Yesterday, the conservative lawmaker who orchestrated the ouster of Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, resigned as the Speaker of the lower house in Congress because indignation was rising over his attempt to remain in power while he's facing charges of taking as much as $40 million in bribes.
Well,
would he be an exceptional case?
The depressing thing is that he's not an exceptional case. Something like 60% of Congress is facing investigations or accusations of corruption, other crimes, even murder. And it's really incredible to have watched between 2010 when I arrived and 2016 when I left. I just moved to New York last month. How much that feeling of euphoria that was everywhere in the air in 2010 has completely changed and gone to the other extreme.
Well, this is a country that is rich in resources. It's one of the world's 10 largest economies. It's a top exporter of oil, iron ore, soybeans, and beef. Is the problem just simply the inequality?
Inequality is one of Brazil's biggest and most urgent problems, and it has been basically since the founding of Brazil as a country. And, you know, during these boom years that we saw under President Lula, who was president from 2003 to 2010, was people rising from poverty and becoming consumers for the first time ever. And a big part of the boom we saw, yes, had to do with commodities, but also had to do with a lot of people entering the formal economy for the first time. But there's still so far to go in that respect, and it's really something that holds the country back.
So was Lula a mixed blessing because people entered the economy was booming, but at the same time, he's also under a dark cloud?
He is. He is.
There was a lot of corruption during his administration. Was corruption part of what greased the wheels of progress, as some people have suggested in other situations?
Well, I think that people who like Lula would argue that it was. And it's a really difficult question because the Workers' Party, his party, came to power promising that it was going to be different from the corrupt old elite that had ruled Brazil for so long. But they came into power and found that if they wanted to get things done, the easiest way to do it was by participating in the exact same kinds of schemes that have always been a part of the way that government is done in Brazil. So they bought votes in Congress, basically. And there is this pragmatic idea that, you know, buying votes was somehow morally justifiable because it was what allowed Brazil to become a more equitable country. Now, I think this pragmatism ended up going too far and became a goal in itself and ultimately kind of destroyed the party and has a big big part to do now with the reason that it's fallen out of favor.
Did they try to improve the life in the favelas and some of the other dismal areas that have made Brazil kind of infamous?
I think that the best thing that Lula did was to create this welfare program called Bolsa Família, Family Allowance. And basically, it paid a couple dollars a day to families if they sent their kids to school and got them vaccinated. And that made malnutrition plunge during his presidency. He also very aggressively increased the minimum wage. And these were essential measures for improving life for the poorest Brazilians, Brazilians who live in favelas, which are these slums in every Brazilian city where residents build their own homes, have very few public services. So, you know, he provided a kind of base for a lot of these people. Unfortunately, there's still a really long way to go. And some of the other policies that his government and the one that came after pursued made it harder to keep improving public services for these people. They ended up putting a lot of money into corporate tax breaks, subsidized loans for big corporations. This very contradictory set of policies for an ostensibly left-wing movement.
My guest is Alex Quadros, who's written a book called Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, and Decadence and Hope in an American Country. It's published by Spiegel and Grau. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Alex Quadros, C-U-A-D-R-O-S. His book, Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country. It's published by Spiegel and Grau. We're really talking about a country that has three major cities that all seem very different. You lived in São Paulo, but would your experience have been very different if you'd been in Rio de Janeiro or in the capital?
Well, São Paulo is really different from Rio. I think Rio embodies the kind of cliche image of what Brazil is supposed to be. That's where the beaches are. That's where this dramatic topography, these thrusting mountains coming out of the sea are. That's the center of where Bossa Nova happened and so on. São Paulo is a really different kind of city.
It's like Rio or, it's like Buenos Aires or more like New York?
It's like, I think it's like New York must have been in the 70s and 80s. A big, messy city. Sort of chaotic, gritty, but also with this amazing energy in the people because it draws people from all over.
Does it hurt the governing of the country that Brasilia is separate from these two major cities?
Well, Brasilia was actually a project of Brazilian leaders going back centuries, actually. They'd wanted to create a new capital in the middle of the country where there was nothing in the hopes that would help integrate the territory. And between 1956 and 1960, they created an entire city from scratch. And I think it's fair to wonder if that was really the smartest use of resources when there were so many people in the country with urgent needs.
Although it is one of the most beautiful architectural places in the world, I think. You've written that you hadn't been reporting about the Brazilian billionaires for very long before you found yourself becoming obsessed with them. Apart from their wealth, did they tend to be interesting people?
Absolutely. And I think that's part of what made it easy to say yes when Bloomberg asked me if I wanted to cover these people as a full-time job, is that they're extreme characters almost without exception. I think that, you know, especially the self-made ones, in order to have the kind of obsessive drive for expansion that allows you to become a billionaire, you can't be like most people.
You write about Ike Batista, who you call a man of almost pathological charisma. Did you ever meet him?
I never met him in person, but I spoke to him on the phone a couple of times. one time. It was when Bloomberg was about to launch its list of the world's richest people. And he wasn't happy with where we were putting him on the list, even though we were saying he was worth $30 billion and the world's 10th richest person. He thought he should be higher.
And he wanted to be the world's richest person.
He did. He was totally unabashed about his megalomaniacal ambition. And when he called me, because we had him some $5 billion lower than he thought he should be, he started yelling at me and even called me primitive.
Instead, he lost everything. Can you give us a quick summary of how Ikey Batista made all that money and then lost it?
The secret to his success was surfing this wave of enthusiasm about Brazil as a country that was on the brink of becoming a new world power. And so he started these companies and he said, I'm going to create this company that's going to mine iron ore to ship to China. And I'm going to create an oil producer with these offshore oil deposits that I've bought. And he created a series of companies from scratch, raised billions of dollars from private investors, all of whom believed him when he said he was going to create this empire of unprecedented proportions in Brazil and maybe in the world. But it turned out that he didn't exactly have what he'd promised. And when that started to become clear, people started selling shares in his companies, and it all tumbled down amazingly quickly. He couldn't pay back his debts and ended up going bankrupt.
You say he was heavily dependent on winning the favor of government officials and securing massive transfers of public money to his own projects and accounts. And you explain that in general, there's no clear line in Brazil between public and private money and interests. Aren't transactions that outsiders would consider corrupt, perhaps, at least a conflict of interest, routinely accepted inside Brazil?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that what we're seeing right now in Brazil, this political chaos that doesn't seem to end, you know, the president is undergoing impeachment, is actually a clash between two visions of how the country is supposed to be. Is Brazil going to be a country where business and government happen in a transparent way? And I think that that's what a part of Brazil aspires to. Or is it going to be a country where corruption greases the gears and that's just the way things are? And that's kind of an older Brazil.
A lot of listeners have been calling in or writing on Twitter asking whether Brazil in any way is similar to what we're seeing in the United States, especially with the growing inequality of rich and poor.
I think it is. And the subtitle of the book, where I refer to Brazil as an American country, is trying to hint at that. And I think that the relationship we see in Brazil between billionaires and the government and the inequality we see is an extreme version of what we see in the United States, and maybe a cautionary tale of where we might be headed.
Did you get the impression that Brazil's wealthiest businessmen honestly believe that what's good for their companies is good for Brazil as a whole? Kind of like what we heard many years ago, what's good for GM is good for America?
This was actually one of the most surprising things about talking to these people, was to realize that greed is way too simplistic an explanation for their motivation in creating these empires. They, I think, largely truly believe that what they're doing is not just pursuing their own self-interest and, you know, trying to get rich, but is actually good for society as a whole. And I think that this kind of justification is necessary, because otherwise, how can you live with that kind of almost obscene wealth?
Isn't there also a danger to becoming this rich in Brazil? Because kidnapping seems to be a constant problem or constant threat.
There was a time in Brazil when kidnapping was incredibly commonplace, especially in the 90s and the early 2000s. And famously, one of the billionaires I spoke to and profiled in the book, Abílio Diniz, was kidnapped and held for 6 days and ransomed. And at a certain point, the police found the hideout, and it looked like there was going to be a showdown. And his kidnappers had been tortured and said they weren't going to go down, or they weren't going to turn themselves in. They were going to go down shooting. And he only managed to get out alive because the Archbishop of São Paulo intervened.
But many of them live in guarded, walled compounds, almost fortresses. Don't they also need to employ bodyguards for all their family members, have bulletproof glass installed in their cars, and even buy kidnapping insurance?
The billionaires end up as like walking enterprises on their own. They have the companies that they run, and then they have their personal life, which becomes a kind of company because it requires so many staff to tend to every need, and security definitely is one of them.
What about when they go shopping? Do they have special places where they can be protected?
I think on the whole, they have people to shop for them. You know, if you're talking about, say, buying a work of art, then they're going to have a private meeting with their dealer. You know, they're not going to be at the gallery with the hoi polloi for the most part.
Is this why they seem to vacation in Miami so frequently? Because they can just walk around without that kind of fear?
A lot of wealthy Latin Americans and Brazilians especially have homes in Miami. They have investments in Miami. And part of the appeal of it is that, you know, in their home countries, they feel unsafe. People are going to recognize them. And in Miami, at least in certain parts of it, you know, they can live this kind of secure life, show off their wealth, ride around in a convertible with the top down without worrying that they're going to be held up. People say that Miami is the capital of Latin America, and it's definitely the capital of wealthy Latin America.
The early press on Brazil's readiness for the Summer Olympics has included the kinds of discussions about cost overruns and construction delays we saw when Brazil hosted the World Cup in 2014. Have you heard much about how things are going now, now that you've come back to the United States?
Well, I've been following this very closely, and I was actually just in Rio the week before last reporting on this. And yes, some things are late. Most of the supporting facilities are done. The metro extension looks like it may not be ready in time for the Olympics, but...
Well, why wouldn't it be? There are a lot of people who are a lot of smart people, competent people. There are a lot of people who I'm sure would be very happy to build these things.
It is being built, but bureaucracy is one of the banes of existence in Brazil, and it's something that infects every part of economic life in the country. And the problem is that you have a political system that's based largely on patronage, where you hand out, you know, important posts to your friends and family instead of to qualified technocrats. And the end result of this is that you have major failures in public policy and in just the basic day-to-day running of government.
Antonio asks on Twitter, what kind of growth is expected in the economy for Brazil? What sectors are booming?
Almost nothing is booming right now in Brazil. The country is in the second year of recession, the deepest recession in possibly a century. Things really don't look good. At the same time, there are a few sectors that are booming. Mainly because they're new, like tech. I know people who have startups in São Paulo that are growing at double-digit rates just because these markets are still so small.
Some of the other millionaires you write about, we don't have time to go into the details, are Paulo Maluf, who was responsible for building Brazil's Big Worm Freeway. He's become sort of poster boy for patronage. There is Blairo Maggi, who's a soy farmer, who is the governor of Mato Grosso, who's routinely battled environmentalists over deforestation. And we didn't get into the whole matter of whether the Amazon is under serious threat. There's Roberto Marinho, who built the Rede Globo TV network. Is he one of the good guys?
I would not place him among one of the good guys exactly. He was a fascinating character. He created Brazil's largest media empire, and his TV network at one point was essentially a monopoly in Brazil. And they said that a fact was not a fact until it appeared on his nightly news show. And he was very aware of his power, and he was very open about using this power. He had an idea of what the country should be doing and what it should look like, and he kind of pushed that on his viewers and on politicians.
Unlike Rupert Murdoch. Should we be surprised, or Bloomberg for that matter? The three billionaires from Rio control brands that we think of as totally American: Budweiser, Burger King, Heinz and Kraft. So they do have a real impact on American industry.
Absolutely. These are these three guys, the richest of which is named Jorge Paulo Lehmann. And they have used the financial markets very successfully to become these kind of takeover tycoons.
My great thanks to Alex Quadros, whose book, Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country, is published by Spiegel and Grau. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Well, thank you.